Good morning and welcome to the Barbara Jordan Conference Center and to this briefing on pulling the trigger. Now, this is not about gun control or about guns. This is, in fact, about health care and Medicare, because you're at the Kaiser Family Foundation and we do health care. And it's about a new requirement that a funding warning be issued if general tax revenues need to cover more than 45% of Medicare's costs within a 7-year period, 2 years in a row, and then the president is supposed to make some recommendations on how to slow spending. This is a relatively new requirement in the Medicare program. It's a kind of controversial requirement, one that I think warrants a broader discussion. So today what we're trying to do is to shed some light on where this provision came from, what this provision means, and how it would work. And we'll have a great panel to really kick us off on this discussion. We're going to start by having Peter Orszag, the director of the Congressional Budget Office, provide us with a brief overview of the trigger itself, how it works, and some of the implications, and then turn to our distinguished panel, Julie Goon, John Rother, and Marilyn Moon, to provide us with some commentary and then open it up to some questions. As you all know, Julie Goon is a special assistant to the President for Economic Policy in the National Economic Council. She's responsible there for health care issues. Marilyn Moon, Vice President and Director of the Health Care Program of the American Institutes for Research, is a former public trustee for Social Security and Medicare, and obviously a longtime expert in the work of Medicare. And John Rother, Director of Policy and Strategy at AARP, and they're in charge of their federal and state public policies. So I think that our panel can give you a lot of insight into this program and how the trigger may or may not work and what some of the implications are. So I'm going to start off by asking Peter to provide us with the overview, and then we'll get the panelists going with their commentaries and then get your questions and hopefully at the end of the day understand a lot more about how this provision in Medicare law works. So Peter, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you all for being here. I guess it's a tribute to all of you that you want to start your morning by talking about the Medicare trigger, but let's get into it. First, a little bit of context, which you all know, but I think is important to keep in mind. Clearly, our healthcare costs and our health programs are the key to our fiscal future. As this chart very clearly illustrates, the nation's fiscal future is determined primarily by the rate at which Medicare and Medicaid costs will grow in the future. You can see that line in our central projections rising much more rapidly than other types of spending as a share of the economy. Furthermore, there does appear to be very substantial opportunities for efficiency improvements in the health sector. And I think it is important to keep those in mind when evaluating any policy changes. It is striking to me, we've formed a panel of health advisors at CBO, and credible academics on that panel believe that we could reduce healthcare costs by 30% without harming health outcomes. 30% of 16% of GDP is 5% of GDP. There is not a single credible academic estimate of anything else, whether it's impediments to international trade, the distortions associated with marginal tax rates. Go down the list. All of those things tend to get you efficiency losses in the range of maybe a half or 1% of GDP. Nothing is remotely close to 5% of GDP. This force and this opportunity for more efficiency is the key to our fiscal future. It's affecting state budgets and crowding out support for higher education. And I think it's also affecting worker anxiety and the well-being of American households, because I think most Americans do not realize how much take-home pay they are foregoing in order to obtain their employer-sponsored insurance, and the lack of salience of how much take-home pay is being reduced as a result, which we know actually is the way that employer-sponsored insurance ultimately is financed, facilitates a lack of demand for more efficiency in the healthcare system. That is to say, because American workers don't realize how much they're giving up for their health insurance, there's less demand for efficiency in the sector than would otherwise be the case. So that's all sort of background. Now let's turn to the mechanics of the Medicare trigger itself. As you all know, the MMA created this excess general revenue funding warning, which requires that if the trustees project that the share of total Medicare spending paid by non-dedicated revenue sources, and I'm going to be more specific in a second, for the current year and the subsequent 6 years exceeds 45% of spending, and I'll come back to that, a warning is triggered. Such a warning has been triggered, and the president has submitted legislation to the Congress, which is treated in a special way under these provisions on a sort of fast-track course, and we can talk more about the specifics of the legislative process also. The president's proposal has several components involving requiring the Secretary of HHS to promote electronic health records, price transparency, other measures, modify medical malpractice law, and change the way in which the Medicare prescription drug benefit subsidy is works for higher income beneficiaries. I bet that we'll hear more about these provisions from Julie in a bit. So let's talk about the mechanics of the formula for a second. General revenue funding, the share of general revenue funding, is defined as total outlays minus dedicated revenues over total outlays. One of my jobs as CBO director is to walk through simple algebra, so I'm going to be doing that with regard to this simple algebraic formula. Total outlays, basically what you do is you take Part A, B, C, and D benefits, you add them together, you add administrative expenses, and then there are a few other small outlays from the Part A and Part B trust funds that are also included in total outlays. Dedicated sources of funding are basically payroll taxes, and the component of the income taxation of benefits for higher income beneficiaries that is dedicated to the hospital insurance trust fund, and then the income from state transfers that were associated with the creation of the Medicare prescription drug benefit. So basically think of it as payroll taxes that go into the hospital insurance trust fund, premiums, and then a small component from both the income taxation of benefits and from these state transfers. All right, now here's where we need to go through the algebra. I'm going to give you a hypothetical example, and then I'll give you a real example. Let's say that total outlays are $100 and dedicated revenues are $45, in which case general revenue as a percentage of total outlays is 55%. So the trigger would be triggered, or the warning would be triggered. Now let's say you want to address that by moving that share below 45%. The key thing you need to remember is how you do it matters a lot. In particular, if you add $10 in dedicated revenues, the formula then is 100 minus $55 over $100, and you get to your 45% threshold. If you reduce Part A outlays by $10, you do not get to 45%. You get instead to 50%, and you can see that right there. And the reason is that you're affecting part of the numerator and also the denominator. If you reduce Part B outlays by $10, you actually have an even smaller effect because you're also then reducing Part B premiums by roughly a quarter of your effect on Part B outlays. And as you remember, the premiums are part of the dedicated revenue flow. So if you reduce Part B outlays by $10, your net impact is 90 minus 42.5 because of that offsetting impact on Part B premiums. And the result is that you're only down to 52.8%. The key takeaway here is that you get you have to reduce spending in Part B the most, and then in Part A, and then finally in terms of additional dedicated revenue because of the way that the formula is constructed. So it's not proportionate across different kinds of adjustments. If we actually look at the real-world example of what needs to happen in order to reduce the projected trigger for 2018 to 45%. If you wanted to do it through dedicated revenues, you need to add $51 billion. If you want to do it through Part A outlays, you have to reduce it by $94 billion. And then if you want to do it through Part B outlays, you have to reduce those by $158 billion, three times as large as the additional dedicated revenue that would be necessary. So one of the lessons here, I think, is unless we were intending to create asymmetries across the different kinds of adjustments, and perhaps we were, that one always needs to be careful with any simple formula because the results just following directly from the algebra can produce very differential incentives for how adjustments are done. In other words, this is not a policy-neutral formula if you view policy-neutral as any $10 adjustment should generate the same kind of impact. Okay, so what will CBO be doing? We actually have no formal role in the statutorily defined process. We have been asked to score the legislation that the administration has put forward in the context of this trigger, and we will be doing so in a matter of days or weeks, not months. The other thing that people often ask us, although it's not of direct relevance to the way that the statute is written, is what kinds of results obtain in our baseline for this general funding trigger. And so I just give you there the general revenue funding share under our baseline. And as you see, in our new baseline, actually in 2013, we do cross the 45% threshold, and it continues rising thereafter, reaching 51% by 2018. So I'd be happy during the question and answer period to answer more detailed questions about the formula, but I just wanted to at least lay out what it contains and particularly highlight that the effort level, if you will, to get the share below 45% varies very significantly depending on what type of adjustment you're doing. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter. Marilyn.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here, and I'm very glad that Peter took the first shot at this because, as you can tell, it's a fairly complicated measure. And when I was thinking about this last night and having watched a little bit of one of my favorite news programs, The Daily Show, I was thinking, how would Jon Stewart respond if he could figure out a way to make this simple and talk about it? And he would probably put his hand over his mouth and do one of those funny little expressions, which I can't try to imitate. And say, oh, really, this is what's going to happen under this proposal. The irony is I believe that this was a proposal that was really intended to signal that general revenues, which are a part of the funding of Medicare and have been from the very beginning, should have a limit in much the same way that the payroll tax is limited by law. But the irony of that is that I think that people got very much the opposite of what they wanted in many cases. For example, if you're very concerned about Medicare spending, the easiest way to deal with this rule, as Peter pointed out, is to simply increase revenues in some other part of the program. So if you were a conservative person, you're going to say, that's kind of wacky. Why are you pushing me in that direction? And if you're a more liberal person, you're going to say, this is an incredibly arbitrary and stupid rule. So I think in many ways everyone should agree and do away with this trigger, but I'm not sure that that's what's going to happen. I want to just make a couple of points because I know we're supposed to be quick so that we can have a good discussion about this. I think, as you can tell, I'm going to say that this is a poor measure no matter what, no matter who you are, if you think about it very carefully, because of this biggest bang per buck aspect that I think Peter has very carefully and well illustrated. The other is that you might ask, why put limits on the Medicare program in this way, and why have limits at all? And I think one of the interesting things to ask then is, why are general revenue shares rising over time? First of all, it's not a, shouldn't be too much of a surprise for anybody who has looked at this Medicare program. First, growth in healthcare spending, as Peter also talks about very eloquently in a number of forums, is rising, although it is not particularly anything unique at all to the Medicare program. It's part of the healthcare system as a whole. And so that's going to cause the general revenue share to rise over time as well, because healthcare is going up faster than general income, which is usually then captured through the income tax. Secondly, the general revenue share is rising even faster because as the healthcare system has changed over time, shifting things out of hospitals and into the outpatient sector, into the ambulatory sector, we have seen general revenues rise faster than the demands on payroll taxes in the hospital side. So Part B has grown as a share overall of the Medicare program. Again, not a surprise, and actually good policy in terms of staying up to date with the way that healthcare should change. And thirdly, it's because of Medicare Part D, because we explicitly, in the exact same legislation that established the trigger, added new general revenue support to the program. So in very many ways, you could say, what were they thinking, and why think about a general revenue trigger? The other thing that bothers me in my last point is that by putting restrictions on financing options in terms of general revenues, in many ways that's the exact opposite of what we should be thinking about. Many people raise the issue of whether high-income seniors and persons with disabilities should pay more for their care, for example. Well, a general revenue tax essentially achieves that much more effectively than a payroll tax, for example. And I don't lose the irony at all that the president's proposal includes a high-income tax, essentially by raising the premiums for the Part D program as well. Much more efficiently done through general revenues through the income tax, I would argue, and much less of a divisive factor, which then creates seniors' taxes as opposed to a general revenue approach overall.
Good morning. I'm going to try to be a little provocative by saying I actually think it's useful to have a trigger, but not this trigger. I do think it's useful to have a regular way to look at Medicare as a whole program. And the trustees only look at the financing. What the trigger implies, or could imply, is that we should be looking more broadly, as Peter is trying to do, at Medicare's growth and performance as a health system relative to the rest of the healthcare system in the United States. In a way, the trigger is moving us a little away from the traditional focus on Part A solvency, which is also completely the wrong measure. So some mechanism that calls us to look at the performance of the Medicare program on a regular basis could be useful. This mechanism, in my view, is not. If we were going to really look at Medicare's performance, we'd look at cost growth relative to private sector cost growth. We'd look at measures of quality and patient satisfaction. We'd look at burden on providers and participation in the program, things that have to do with performance, not the balance between dedicated and non-dedicated financing sources. A little history might be useful here. This trigger, in my view, is the product of one person's imagination. That's former chair of Ways and Means, Bill Thomas. He pushed hard for a 40% trigger that would be a hard trigger that would actually force action in the Congress. And in the course of the negotiations over the Medicare bill, it became 45% as a more or less figure pulled out of thin air, and also became a soft trigger as opposed to a hard trigger. So what's the impact? Well, the impact is, I think, that people are going to dismiss the trigger instead of using it as an opportunity to look more carefully at Medicare in terms of its performance. The trigger has some misleading policy biases, if you will, in addition to the ones that Maryland outlined. It seems to me in healthcare we want services where appropriate to migrate from inpatient to outpatient. It's usually less expensive. That's been the trend. This would imply that that's a negative when, in fact, it's probably a positive. It would certainly imply that more progressive forced sources of financing are less desirable than the payroll tax. And I think the biggest problem with this is it's not looking at the whole program. Instead, it's looking at one set of financing sources compared to another. And I think that's kind of a silly way, frankly, of evaluating a healthcare program. We wouldn't try to look at any other healthcare program that way by evaluating it in terms of a ratio of financial sources. In terms of the politics of this, I think those who proposed it certainly understood that the trigger would be pulled. and wanted some kind of automatic mechanism similar to solvency but occurring earlier than solvency that would force a congressional reexamination of the program. And those who favored it wanted a defined contribution type arrangement or philosophy in Medicare and thought that maybe this would help move us there. I actually don't think that's going to happen. I don't think that's, when you look at the suggestions put forward by the administration to implement the trigger, it's not that at all. So I think that the politics of this have not worked out the way that perhaps people who were responsible for it intended. And as Marilyn said, the huge irony of financing the drug benefit from general revenues to a large extent, and then at the same time saying, stop us before we do it again. So I, like Marilyn, believe that Congress should repeal this trigger or at least change it. I also think that the one annual report that does look at the program, namely the trustees report, could become more useful if they incorporated a broader set of measures beyond just the usual Part A insolvency standard. It's about time that we really start taking a more in-depth look at what we're actually getting for a Medicare dollar in terms of the adequacy of its benefits, the extent to which it actually promotes health, the extent to which it performs either better or worse than the rest of the healthcare system. And if not the trustees, then maybe some other body. And I think Peter has been terrific in terms of equipping CBO to take more of that role. Finally, I just say that the underlying problem here is the problem of cost containment in healthcare. And rather than debating ratios of financing, we should be thinking more about how to lower the rate of increase overall. And my belief is to do that, we have to look at healthcare system-wide, not just at Medicare, not just at programs that are publicly financed. So if we can change or come up with another trigger that lets us do that, then I think this would be a much more worthwhile discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Julie.
excuse me. Thank you. I find myself in a unique position of actually agreeing with almost all of my colleagues here on the panel in many of the specifics of what they raised. I think that one of the where I disagree is I don't think that we should make the perfect the enemy of the good. And is this trigger a perfect mechanism for looking at the whole entire Medicare program? I don't think so. I think there are a lot of factors that go into what we want to look at when we look at Medicare. However, I do think that one of the important elements that this trigger has brought forward is that we're actually having this conversation here. We're having this conversation in a lot of places around Washington, and we actually have a mechanism in place to facilitate that kind of conversation on Capitol Hill this year. Peter did a terrific job of explaining how the trigger works, you know, what happens as a result of the trigger with the president submitting legislation 15 days after the budget the following year, after, you know, a funding warning is triggered after two consecutive trustees reports indicate that we're going to be over this 45% ratio within a seven-year period of time. Looking back at the debate during the MMA, this certainly at the time that I was the 2003 and the debate were going on, I wasn't a member of the administration, and this wasn't something that I don't think a lot of people downtown necessarily focused on the Medicare funding trigger. But the debate at that time was precipitated, I think, by the work of the Medicare Commission and by Congressman Thomas. There were a number of variations on the trigger that were considered but not ultimately adopted, including references to insolvency, putting a hard cap on Medicare spending if, in fact, this trigger was pulled. tabled eliminating the rights to filibuster in the Senate as part of the process that would occur if the warning was triggered. Some people sought a point of order providing that when Medicare general revenues rose above 45%, it would not be in order to consider legislation that would increase the general revenue funding of Medicare. At the time, I think the administration supported a 40% trigger instead of 45%. Are these numbers somewhat arbitrary? More than likely. But they do sort of give an indication of how much money is coming out of the general revenue basket and being spent on Medicare and other health care programs to the detriment of spending in other parts of the government. This is one of the few ways where we actually get focused attention on that. It was also the outgrowth of earlier ideas about putting together a combined trust fund for Medicare's Part A and B to warn us when Medicare as a whole was going to be problematic. The president's budgets in the last couple of years have also proposed putting in place a sequester that would be tied to the trigger warning. Those proposals have not passed, obviously. The 2009 budget that the president submitted addresses nearly one-third of Medicare's $34 trillion unfunded obligation over the next 75 years, and over a five-year period of time, it would save taxpayers $178 billion. One of the questions that I got asked before coming to do this was, you know, why didn't we just submit our budget again? And frankly, the fact was that as we looked at what we were going to be doing this year, we had submitted the budget. The budget's out there. Everybody can see it. Everybody knows what policy options are available in the budget. The budget explicitly, you know, whether you like it or not, it lets people know what kind of choices we're going to be facing over, you know, the next 5-10 years, regardless of who's in charge of Congress, regardless of who's in the administration. There's a lot of low-hanging fruit in Medicare that's already been taken care of, and really hard choices face us with respect to provider payments, what the benefits are in Medicare, what the program looks like. I think there are a lot of ways we can achieve better efficiency in the Medicare program, as Peter indicated, and in part that was what informed the discussion inside the White House about what we would be submitting with respect to this funding warning. So, as I said, the package that we submitted sort of complements the budget. The budget would take care of a lot of the funding issues that are still up on that slide. I think, in fact, if the president's budget passed in 2013, that 45.1% number would be down to 38%, and in 2018, it'd be back up to 39%. But the provisions that are in the trigger package actually focused more on introducing more value-driven competition into the Medicare program. And many of you may remember that in the summer of 2006, the president signed an executive order calling on the VA, the DOD, OPM, and HHS to start introducing these principles into the programs that they administer, the principles of more information, transparent pricing information, consistent measures of quality that then are made more transparent to consumers, electronic health records and interoperable health IT systems, and incentives for really looking at high-quality, low-cost health care. Now, those principles have been easier to input into certain programs than others. As everyone knows, Medicare and Medicaid are driven in large part by the statutory restrictions around those programs. So to a certain extent, the Secretary can try and introduce these kind of system-wide changes to Medicare and Medicaid. But in many areas, he is probably going to need legislation passed. And so as we looked at this submission for the trigger, we really wanted to take the opportunity to focus again on how you could update the Medicare program for the 21st century and lay the groundwork for a more efficient system. In addition, Title II of the package implements the president's medical liability reform ideas. As folks have talked about health care costs, one of the drivers of health care costs has been the medical liability crisis, which has hindered patient care, flooded the courts with lawsuits, cost the health care system up to $100 billion a year. And this is one way of at least focusing attention on health care costs. And then The other provision, which actually brings us into compliance with the trigger warning under the assumptions in the 2007 Medicare Trustees Report, is, of course, the Medicare Part D premium subsidy, changing that to income-related in a similar way to Part B, but without the indexing provision. I just want to say briefly before I sit down and we get into, I think, the back-and-forth conversation, that the criticism that the trigger is an incomplete picture of the program's health, of course it is. I don't think it's ever been intended to be a full picture of what the Medicare program looks like. It is not a perfect measure. It is an improvement over just using exhaustion of the Part A trust fund. I think some of the other indicators that Marilyn and John mentioned, the number of workers per beneficiary, the overall costs of Medicare as a percentage of GDP, are extremely important. Does the trigger treat different revenues differently? Yes, it does. But if you're going to do something like increase payroll taxes, that would require legislative action, and so it would require the Congress and policymakers to deliberate fashion, address the growth of Medicare head-on. Increasing general revenues right now happens automatically, so not having this kind of trigger also means that we are sort of acting in a certain policy direction without actually necessarily facing the growing burden of Medicare. And with that, I think I'll stop, and we can go to the questions and answers. Thanks.
Thank you, Julie, and thank you, all the panelists. I think you've heard a lot of consistent views around the trigger and a lot of insights into some of the issues around reforming and using the trigger or how it might work. But I think one thing that might be important is to first step back and to really try and get a measure of why Medicare spending is growing and what some of the issues are. There's been a lot of discussion about it's about us baby boomers and the aging of the population, but there have been other commentaries that really look much more fundamentally at health care as a national problem. And I know, Peter, you've made some comments on that, and I wondered if you'd like to elaborate a bit on the underlying cost issues in the Medicare program and how they relate to the overall health system.
Sure. And let me just say, there's been actually in the last week or two some, at least in the blogosphere, some discussion of this. I think the numbers are very clear. If you look out over 20 or 30 years, the role of demographics looms relatively larger than it does out over 60, 70 years. But even over the next 20 or 30 years, it is not the dominant force. It's a bigger force than over 75 years, but it's not the dominant force, either with regard to Medicare and Medicaid or with regard to our overall fiscal future. It is true that as you go out over 75 years, the new CBO methodology, which I would be happy to describe and that I think has a very sound analytical base, produces higher numbers than the trustees do for Medicare, and therefore the role of demographics, relatively speaking, is smaller over 75 years in our projections than in the trustees. But the conclusion the qualitative conclusion is the same in both cases. These programs are on an unsustainable course. Over the next 20 or 30 years, demographics play a somewhat larger role than they do over the next 75 years, but even over that shorter period of time, a far more important factor than the fact that we will have more beneficiaries is that the cost per beneficiary is rising so rapidly. And then the question becomes, why is that happening? And as has already been noted, it's happening not just in Medicare and Medicaid, but in the overall health system. And over long periods of time, the rate at which healthcare cost per beneficiary rise tend to track each other fairly closely in different parts of the health system. And that's not too surprising, given that, you know, doctors are seeing Medicare patients and non-Medicare patients, and hospitals are treating different kinds of patients, and the practice norms tend to be similar across different kinds of patients. So the underlying cost trends also tend to be at least broadly similar across different sectors of the health system. Again, we put out, I think last week or the week before, or maybe a few weeks, the weeks all kind of meld together, two reports that are of relevance here. One looked at the historical contributors to cost growth, and once you try to control for things like changes in insurance coverage, in rising income, demographics, and what have you, at most you can explain perhaps half of the cost growth that has occurred over the past few decades, and I would say the best estimate is significantly lower than that. And the conclusion that follows then is that most of that residual is being driven by the adoption and diffusion of various kinds of medical technologies. And therein lies the tie to the second paper, which has to do with a much more detailed look at the regional variation. I put up the map that I walk around with, the regional variation in Medicare, which, by the way, actually has come down. Interestingly, it's come down over the past two or three decades, mostly because of a reduction in the variation in hospital costs. But it's still very substantial. It exists in the rest of the health system. And one of the reasons that occurs is that a technology, and I use a little example of an MRI, but you can take any technology you want. A technology is invented and introduced into the health system. It, in many cases, generates significant health benefits, allows more precise diagnoses. And so on average, you get the Cutler result that on average, additional healthcare spending has been associated with improvements in health outcomes. But what happens then is the technology diffuses very rapidly into settings in which it has low or maybe even in some cases negative value, which raises costs without improving health outcomes. So it is simultaneously the case that the additional health spending that we have undertaken over the past three or four decades has helped to improve health outcomes, and also the case that there's a very substantial share of costs that are unnecessary and don't improve outcomes. And in order to get at that, you need to change the way that medicine is practiced. And it's not just about Medicare and Medicaid, but Medicare and Medicaid could potentially lead. You need to change the way that technology is diffused throughout the system, the way that medicine is practiced. And I think it will likely involve both more information and a change in financial incentives. Right now, we have a set of financial incentives for more care rather than better care, both in the Medicare and Medicaid system and in the rest of the healthcare system. And that needs to change, but in order to determine what better care is, you need to know what it is. So in order to provide incentives for better care, you need to know what that is, and that requires a much expanded effort at determining when that MRI is beneficial or when it's not, whether the third visit back to the doctor after your surgery is beneficial or not per month, all sorts of things that right now, frankly, we have no idea.
Well, given the sobering comments that we've just heard from Peter, in terms of looking at the
I'm an optimist. Right. I mean, there's a huge opportunity here.
I said they were sobering comments. I didn't say they were pessimistic.
Okay.
What kinds of things, Julie, would the administration, beyond looking specifically within the Medicare and Medicaid program in terms of your budget proposals, be looking at in terms of affecting overall health care?
Well, I want to answer that question, but I also would like to just take the opportunity to ask Peter, as you look at increasing medical technology, is there a way to break down how much of that is being developed because of the aging of the population currently? I mean, a lot of the things that we hear about, you know, in terms of innovation, both in terms of, you know, drug development and technology development, is done because there's an increasing need as this huge group of people age. And maybe the misuse of it or the, you know, diffusion of that technology in a inefficient and wasteful way is now it's being provided to people who don't necessarily need it. But is there any kind of correlation or have you guys looked at that, or is that something that's possible to look at?
Well, I'd say a couple things. First, even while demographic changes were less prominent, so you go back to the 70s and 80s, technological advances and diffusion were still apparently the dominant force. So when the population is aging rapidly, when it's not aging rapidly, this seems to be a significant force. A related point is that people often say, well, okay, that's one way of looking at it, but we also know that healthcare costs are very concentrated among catastrophic cases. And I don't think that that's actually an inconsistent perspective. We are treating those catastrophic cases in much different ways across different parts of the country, and we often don't know what we're getting in exchange. So an example, if you look at Medicare beneficiaries in the last 6 months of life and you compare, take your favorite academic medical center. I've been using UCA Medical and I've been beating up on them too much, so now let me use UCSF instead. Average cost per beneficiary at UCSF is a little north of $40,000 per beneficiary last 6 months of life. At the Mayo Clinic, it's $26,000. We are all paying for that difference, and we have absolutely no idea what we're getting in exchange for it. And those are all relatively sick people and old people. And we do not know what we're getting in exchange for it.
Before you get back to Julie's answer on her question, I'd also like to add to this, though, that if you look at expenses in the last year of life on aggregate, they have not changed very much over the last 20 or 30 years as a share of total spending. And I think that's an important thing to recognize, that also if you look at prognosis or if you look at age, and by prognosis I mean expectation that you'd survive, we spend a lot more. If you look at age, we spend a lot more the younger you are. So it's not end-of-life care that's driving this. I think Peter is making a different point, but it's easy because a lot of people do talk about end-of-life care as if we could reduce that, we would solve all the problems, and we wouldn't. And in fact, if you look at the top 5% by spending, it's about 45%, I think, of all Medicare expenditures. About 5% of people die each year in the Medicare program, and that's 28% of Medicare expenditures. So you have to be careful about where we're putting that technology. Unfortunately, if we could say it's for futile care and do with that, then we could deal with it more easily. So it's a little bit more complicated. The other thing I would mention is that for older Americans, a lot of care is actually less intensive in terms of technology as individuals grow older. So that's another factor. And finally, the development of all those blockbuster drugs, first of all, people start taking them at about age 50, not at 65. And secondly, that occurred in a period of time in which there was no drug coverage under Medicare. So I don't think there's very much evidence that we can point to Medicare and Medicaid for driving health care costs up overall.
Could I add one other comment, which is related on on obesity, because it's so, you know, people often say, well, aging, and then they say chronic people who have multiple chronic conditions, and then obesity. It is the case that a much larger share today of healthcare spending is devoted to obese beneficiaries relative to normal weight beneficiaries, as the share of the population has gone up. That is not, however, mostly due to the fact that there are more obese beneficiaries. It is mostly due to the fact that each obese beneficiary is being treated more expensively than in the past, which is to say, if the relative cost per obese beneficiary were the same as in the mid-1980s, and then you just roll forward and have the body mass index distribution what it is today, you can only explain a very small share of the overall increase in healthcare costs. It is rather that we are treating each obese beneficiary in a much more intense and expensive way that is the primary cause of that higher share devoted to obese beneficiaries. So in lots of cases, as you start to parse the data, the sort of easy conclusion that you come to is not actually the right one.
Yeah, and the only thing I was going to add to this discussion is I wasn't actually talking about the last 6 months of life so much as people do age, and hit 50 or hit 60 and then hit 65. There are more use of services in that age cohort, and a lot of the things that seem to be being developed and innovated for chronic diseases and multiple chronic diseases seem to be for people who are there, not necessarily for people who are younger. And I've just been interested in reading your stuff, how you break all that out to actually figure out the actual impact of an aging population versus just healthcare costs overall.
Well, and again, if you just, so let's do this, I don't think I brought this chart, but if you just say, what is the cost per beneficiary today, and obviously the 85-year-old does cost more than the 40-year-old, et cetera. And then you just age the population. You keep cost per beneficiary what it is today, so I'm not going to let healthcare costs per beneficiary go up. We just age the population and make it look like it will in the future. The cost increases that you get are just a very small share of that first graph that I showed you. So by the end of the 75-year window, it explains much less than 10% of the projected increase. And that, in some sense, is the point, although I should note we are going to have more older beneficiaries in the future, and the fact that cost per beneficiary is going up so much has an interaction effect. That is to say, when there are more beneficiaries in the future, the fact that cost per beneficiary is going up gets magnified, and so there's kind of an interaction effect. But even if you include that interaction effect, it's still the case that most of the growth is occurring because of excess cost growth, basically.
And Peter, not to keep turning to you, but I think that the map you showed of the regional variations is kind of the most striking fact of life that we've all come to appreciate. And one of the obvious questions then is, since there seems to be an inverse relationship in many cases to spending in terms of and related to outcomes, what can we do in the way of policy? What levers do we have to address spending in certain parts of the country and not in others? Because it's traditional, of course, in Medicare that anything we do is across the board. But
right.
But the variations implies that across the board is not appropriate given that fact of life.
Well, there are different approaches. In the back part of the regional variation paper that we put out, whenever we put it out, we have a short discussion of policy options. We're doing a massive effort this year, which actually, let me do a little advertising. One of the things that I have that we're doing with all these people that we're recruiting to CBO in healthcare is we are putting together a volume that we're calling Critical Topics in Health Reform, where we're going to go through all of the things that people talk about: health information technology, care coordination, disease management, blah, 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 and provide some clarity about CBO's view of what the impact could be on coverage, on costs, and other dimensions. So if you do this, you might have a budgetary impact of $10 to $50 billion a year, and you do it this way, it's closer to 10, you do it that way, it's closer to 50. In that volume, there will be discussion of the impact on regional variation and different approaches. I would point out a few things quickly, though. First, the variation tends to be larger where we don't know what to do. So administering an aspirin at admission for a heart attack, not a lot of variation. Imaging and diagnostic testing, where it's not really clear what you should do, a lot more variation. It suggests, at least to me, that you could reduce the variation if you had better information and better incentives for better care rather than more care, which is an indirect way of getting at that variation. And the only other thing I would say is, again, it is striking to me, and I'm glad that you said this about that map and the comparisons across, it is striking to me that this kind of inefficiency persists and that we all allow it and we are all paying for it. And there are hordes and hordes and hordes of policy debates on inefficiencies that are much, much smaller in magnitude than what we're talking about here. Someone said to me, yes, basically in all those other cases for the economists in the room, we're talking about triangles. Here we're talking about a rectangle. This is a much bigger deal. And in terms of relative effort, both in my old think tank world and in frankly in the policy world, compared to that opportunity, we're falling short.
To get back to your original question.
I'm really being quite positive today, aren't I?
Peter actually referenced in his remarks some of the other things that we have put forward as ways to get at some of the inefficiency and the excess spending in the healthcare system. And one of the biggest is the current tax subsidy for employer-provided insurance. It's the biggest subsidy in the federal budget. It's, over $250 billion a year, I think. And the proposal that the president put forward to eliminate that tax subsidy so that people actually do have a sense of what their compensation package is, and everybody receiving a standard deduction or a flat tax credit for the purchase of health insurance is one of the things that we have proposed to try and get at both the unlevel playing field that currently exists in the tax system, where if you have to buy insurance on your own, you get no tax benefit for that, as well as a way to involve individuals in thinking up front more about what kinds of health care and health care insurance are right for them and their family. And that's a piece of a number of things. But
can I make a really quick comment?
Sure.
On this.
I want to.
Oh, go ahead, and I'll just. Okay, so first, I want to come back to, I do think that the lack of saliency, this is going to be a broader point. I think for the economists in the room and the policy analysts in the room, we have been trained to focus so much on narrow financial incentives, and we need to pay a lot more attention to ease and simplicity and salience, because the evidence, I believe, is now becoming overwhelming that that stuff is far more important than the narrow financial incentive. So, having to pay a toll out of your pocket generates one response, an easy pass much different thing because you don't think about it. Most American households pay more in payroll taxes than income taxes. You hear more about the income tax because it's more salient. Opting out of a 401k instead of opting in is far more important in terms of participation rates than whatever match rate you want to come up with. We are not paying enough attention to that, and the lack of salience of employer-sponsored insurance costs, I think, does contribute to that variation outside of Medicare in the medical system, because it means that workers are not demanding as much efficiency as they otherwise would. Now, you can address that. One approach is to change the tax treatment. You can also address it simply by providing that information more clearly to workers. It was striking to me, I was at a Brookings conference last week. There were three Harvard professors, two economics professors, and one law professor. One Harvard economics professor said, I tried to figure out how much Harvard contributed for my health insurance, spent 30 minutes on the website, found incorrect information before realizing I was actually covered under my wife's plan. Harvard law professor says, don't you realize that that information is actually provided on your pay stub? Interesting. Of course, but anyway. And then other Harvard economics professor says, yes, but don't you realize that Harvard is no longer sending out paper pay stubs? It's electronic, and you have to sign up for a paper pay stub, and if not, you never see it. So there was like a 30-minute discussion among two PhDs and a outstanding law professor at Harvard University about what information Harvard did or did not provide. And I think that is a little microcosm of a larger point, which is, you know, I won't ask because it would be obnoxious what share of people in this room actually know how much their employers contribute. But I would say in other rooms across the country, the share would be very, very low.
I wanted to pick up on exactly that issue, and so I'm glad that Peter talked about that. Julie mentioned providing more information in general and information about quality and so forth. And the research that my company is doing suggests that we really have to go back to very first principles. We're talking about people who do not understand what evidence base is. We're talking about people who don't know what a guideline is. They think that's a limit on what they get, and it's a bad thing because it's imposed only by insurance executives rather than developed by experts in the field, for example. We're talking about people not only who don't have a clue about the financing, but they don't have a clue about where to get good information about what's necessary or not necessary. This is, though, a big investment. It's not enough to tell members of the administration who run various programs to provide more information. That's costly, and we have to figure out what kind of information it is. If you provide a giant scorecard and nobody pays any attention or knows anything about it, it doesn't do any good. If you provide quality information and the individual takes it to their doctor who says, I'm not going to treat this patient any longer because they're litigious, which is another finding we have from some research we've done, we have a long way to go. And I really think that's one of the areas that is a possible area of dramatic improvement and will, I agree with Peter, overshadow the economic incentives that we can provide. So rather than focusing so much on economic incentives as we often have, I think in many cases doctors and patients want to do the right thing, but they don't know what the right thing is. And one of the easy things is if you're worried about your health care and they say, well, I don't know what it is, an MRI can't hurt, everybody has the incentive to go. You can counter that with making it very expensive, or you can counter that with helping people understand whether or not it works. And I think we need to do some of both, but we've put a lot more emphasis on financial incentives than we have on information.
Well, as you can see, we've quickly gone from talking about the trigger and some of the possible flaws in the trigger to talking about the real underlying problems that make Medicare spending go up and that our health care spending goes up generally. We've had a great discussion among our panelists without any real prompting. They've engaged each other. But now it's your turn to engage them. So we will take questions from the audience. If you could please raise your hand so we can get you a microphone and identify yourself and your organization when you speak, and if you want, direct your question to an individual panelist or to the group.
Hi, I'm Allie Bonebreak with the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. During Ms. Goon's remarks, she mentioned the low-hanging fruit in the Medicare program, and according to the MedPAC recommendations, one way to achieve efficiency in the program is to eliminate the excessive subsidies to Medicare Advantage plans. I believe the latest data says these plans are paid 13% more than traditional Medicare to cover beneficiaries. And I know that the elimination of these subsidies was not included in the president's response to the Medicare funding warning. So here's my question. Would the elimination of these subsidies improve the financial outlook of the Medicare program? And if they were eliminated, would it bring the general revenue funding of Medicare below the 45% level? And what do you guys think about the elimination of these subsidies? Is it good for the program, and does it improve efficiency for Medicare? Thanks.
Good question.
I'm actually going to address your question by pointing to Peter's chart or map. Because the map that shows the differential in spending in the Medicare program across the country would be the same map that you would look at to show what payments look like for Medicare Advantage plans across the country. There are higher payments in certain areas, for example, Miami. Those are driven in part by higher utilization and fee-for-service spending. But if you were going to look at that differential between fee-for-service spending and Medicare Advantage benchmarks, you would find much higher percentage above fee-for-service spending in rural areas of the country where the actual amount of spending is lower. And that was driven by policy decisions made by members of Congress and the administration to increase the number of private plan choices across the country, which has happened. In 1997, the Balanced Budget Act had a number of different policy goals. One was to try and decrease the differential between high payment and low payment counties in the Medicare Advantage program. A lot of that differential has been squeezed out, not all of it, but again, you wouldn't necessarily want to be paying plans in the middle of Iowa, the same thing you were paying plans in Miami. If you looked at the same map and instead said how many private plan choices are available for individuals in the Medicare program, you would have seen in 2003 wide open white parts of America where there were no private plan options, and now that is not the case. Those plans are available across the country. They provide an additional option for beneficiaries. In fact, the president's budget, I mentioned, had $178 billion in cuts to the Medicare program over time. As you very well know, Medicare Advantage benchmarks are tied to fee-for-service spending, and there was 25% of that $178 billion is in reductions to Medicare Advantage benchmarks. Does it eliminate that differential? No, it doesn't. But that differential is in part based on what goes on in the fee-for-service program as well. There have been decisions made to pay critical care access hospitals more. There have been decisions made to make bonus payments to rural providers to ensure that there are providers available in rural areas. There have been, you know, differential kinds of payments to hospice to make sure that all of those services are available for Medicare beneficiaries across the country. And what goes on in the Medicare Advantage program is a similar policy decision to ensure that beneficiaries have those kinds of options.
Okay, so let me answer your question in the following way. Reducing payments to Medicare Advantage plans would improve the actuarial status of the Part A trust fund, and it would have an effect on Part B premiums also, which just reflects the budgetary scores and the 12 or 13% figure, depending on exactly what official institution you're using, in terms of the relative cost. Now, the advocates of Medicare Advantage argue, well, that's all fine and good, but you're leaving out a dynamic impact, that these plans are using those additional payments to undertake various kinds of potentially efficiency-improving experiments, if you will. And that may well be the case. Let me make two points about that. First, at least with regard to their own operations, in order for, given the current formula, Medicare Advantage plans to actually ultimately cost the government less than traditional fee-for-service, without any spillover onto traditional fee-for-service, the efficiency improvements in Medicare Advantage plans would have to be so large, and we've written a letter to, I think, the boss of someone in this room, on this topic, that I think it may raise plausibility questions. And perhaps more importantly, if the way to think about those additional payments is effectively a federal government subsidy for lots of little experiments on what could work and what might not, it is still the case, and I've said this before, but I'll say it again, it is still the case that we are not requiring the kind of reporting and not receiving the kind of information on those little experiments that would be justified and necessary if that's the way we're thinking about this transaction. So if we're going to conduct a bunch of publicly funded experiments in order to figure out what works and what doesn't, we need the information to evaluate what works and what doesn't, and we're not receiving that.
And if I could, I think that the case for throwing more money at managed care does rest on their longer-term ability to organize health care in a more efficient way, produce better outcomes, and we don't know how to measure that very well. But I think if you look at where the money's going today, so much of that goes to private fee-for-service where there's no even a premise or pretense that care is being managed or being used in any way that's more productive than the traditional Medicare program. And I think there's really no justification for extra payments to those type plans. And it does raise costs for beneficiaries, most of whom are not part of these plans. So even if you wanted to finance experiments with managed care in the hope that they could produce longer-term results, it seems unfair to assess people who are not part of those plans for those costs. So I think that there's a timely case for reexamining that whole system.
I'd just like to also reinforce the issue of the private fee-for-service plans. That's where the subsidies are the largest, and actually in some of the lower-paid areas, so the map doesn't look the same. Exactly the same, though, there would still be a differential. I agree that I think the focus should be also on what are we getting for these plans. If there are plans that are truly doing innovative things, then we need reporting, as Peter mentioned. But we also need more discrimination. I don't think you do a demonstration in which you say anybody who wants to come and participate, whether or not you are a forward-thinking plan or not, go right ahead, provide a few extra benefits to beneficiaries, do a couple of things, and then we'll throw the dice and see which ones work. The whole idea of doing in demonstrations is usually to take a legitimate idea and experiment with it in a fairly controlled fashion. So I think that the notion that these are the little laboratories of improvement is a pretty bizarre notion in many ways. There are clearly excellent plans out there providing excellent benefits, and I have no qualms with them. And, in fact, some of them might even deserve some additional payments. But the assumption somehow that by subsidizing these plans they will come up with innovations is pretty cockeyed in terms of the way we treat the rest of the program. It's also the case, I believe, that it's unfair, as John said, to ask Medicare beneficiaries who, for various reasons, either cannot or do not choose to go into private plans to subsidize others, and that's what is happening. It's also not fair to say, well, these plans are offering extra benefits when those extra benefits are not available to the bulk of Medicare beneficiaries. And if we don't do something about this soon, the growth in the number of those plans and a share of the population served is going to create such an incredible strength of political will, if you will, or political force, that it will be very, very difficult to undo this.
I just have to say that in terms of measurement of quality and what we're getting, I don't think we have very good measurement in the fee-for-service program. And all you have to do to figure that out is look at how risk adjustment works in Medicare Advantage and what goes on in all the ins and outs of the CMS, you know, payment formula to figure out a risk score for a beneficiary in fee-for-service, how to normalize that risk score over time, and then how to apply that normalized risk score to a Medicare Advantage plan when there is much more information about what the actual health status of a person in a Medicare Advantage plan is, and that is growing now that risk adjustment is a bigger part of the payment methodology for Medicare Advantage. But we don't have good information about what goes on in fee-for-service at all in terms of the health status of these people and whether they're actually being treated efficiently or not. To get back to the point of differentials around the country, if people remember back in, you know, 1997, before the payment methodology changed, there was a lot of hullabaloo about why would beneficiaries in Iowa be paying for something. They put the same amount of money into Medicare over their lifetime of working, and instead beneficiaries in Florida had all these great options with, at the time, drugs, which is no longer an issue so much, but the private fee-for-service plans that have came into being in part because even with the payment changes, in 1997, there was not an incentive on the part of the provider community in rural counties or in counties where they had a monopoly to sign contracts with plans and be part of a network or an organized system of care that arguably would provide, you know, that level of measurable, consistent, innovative kind of care coordination. At the time, there was a lot of discussion, if you remember way back, when a person joined a Medicare Advantage plan, they had to disenroll from Medicare in order to be part of Medicare Advantage. That is no longer the case, but providers do not treat all Medicare beneficiaries the same. There was a lot of argument in 2003 that if a Medicare Advantage beneficiary was in a rural county where there was a provider that wasn't part of that network and they showed up, would that provider be required to take them? They are not required to take them, even if they're a participating Medicare provider. Private fee-for-service plans didn't really grow until there was a provision that said, okay, we're not putting, these plans aren't putting extra requirements on the providers, so why can't they just pay the deemed Medicare rate? And that's what we've seen a lot of growth in these plans. I don't disagree that over time the increased percentage of people in Medicare Advantage is going to make it difficult to change things in the short term. I do think in the long term, the bigger percentage of people you get in Medicare Advantage and the more the revenue of Medicare Advantage companies is dependent on Medicare, the easier it will be to move to a more rational system than what we have now.
Well, clearly we could do a whole briefing just on that one question. We'll take tomorrow, yeah. We'll take the next question, though, and see if we can yet form another briefing.
Diane, don't cut me off. Sibel the Orkling with Ways and Means. And frankly, I got distracted through the many answers along the way about where exactly I wanted to go with the question, because there, especially with the last series, there was sort of a number of things. I mean, I think to the point of...
Sibel, could you put the mic a little closer?
Sorry. Fee-for-service... not having a lack of knowledge around fee-for-service, it is very hard to hear folks in this administration talk about that, because when Bruce Laddick was the administrator of HCFA, he had asked for kinds of tools to try to impose some more efficiencies on the programs, and the Republican Congress at the time wouldn't give them to him. And this turn of events in the last 6 years, and we've tried to chafe against this in the last year and a half, you know, has been one where the single-minded obsession has been with growing the private plans and a lot of ignoring the underlying fee-for-service. And at least for the time being, it is true, the predominant, overwhelming number of beneficiaries, 80%, are in fee-for-service. But that trend is changing, actually, like this, going into MA because of the excessive subsidies that are on deck. And going back to sort of the topic of today's program and what are we looking at in terms of future financing and the appropriateness of the trigger, et cetera, it is sort of the proverbial elephant in the living room, as Allie brought up, about eliminating this. This should be the fastest and easiest thing we do to take a huge chunk of change out of the program and begin looking forward. For most of the plan's existence in Medicare, they were paid at less than fee-for-service rates. So even in 97, if Iowan beneficiaries were complaining that their sisters in Miami had more drugs, that was still at below fee-for-service rates. It's just going back to Peter's point about geographic variation. More people, the care-seeking and care-providing behavior in Miami generates that. So I think getting back to the map looks very different in MA and much in more grossly distorted with the MA overpayments on the table the way they are. And private fee-for-service is simply paying for choice for choice's sake. We can't get any data about what we're actually buying for it. And you get to a point, if you just have a shadow program that's costing us a lot more, is setting aside the very good and some of the older coordinated care plans that we think might have some value, but still they have fought to deliver encounter data for a long time, so we don't know. But the private fee-for-service really is pointless, and it was born out of a political compromise with National Right to Life in 97. It just had a pernicious effect with the payment changes in 03 in particular. And it's growing right now so fast that if we do not put a lid on it, I believe with Marilyn that we can't. And I don't think, to Julie's point, that we can actually say we're going to be more able to make it more rational when more people and more plan revenues are invested there. So I guess we've sort of beat the dead horse on MA. And the practice of medicine, I mean, I think we need to keep doing it till it's done. But the changing the practice of medicine, to Peter's point, is very difficult. And one of the things that we've been working on a lot, and I think most of the panelists have been involved in, and I guess I'd ask kind of an open-ended question about this, gets to the points on comparative effectiveness research. And I do think that that is one of the only silver bullets. There are no silver bullets in healthcare. It's not a rational purchasing system. So economists have a difficult time dealing with it because any of us who are sitting in the doctor's office say, well, I know that you don't know if the MRI is going to help me, but, gee, if it will, let me do it. And if it costs me $1,000 and I have the discretionary income, I'll do it. If I don't have the discretionary income, maybe I'll do it anyway. So I think we need better data, but there's only so much we can expect a patient to actually do with it. And a lot of the education has to be with the payers and providers. So if we can talk for a quick moment with everybody about the possibilities for a robust comparative effectiveness research program and what sort of elements are needed. We firmly believe there has to be an all-payer system with public and private payers paying in, and I'd just like to see what you guys have to say about that.
Meryl? I fully agree about the comparative effectiveness research and work. That's a public good. If Aetna does enormous amounts of work on comparative effectiveness, they are not, as economists would say, going to put in enough money because they'll only reap some of the benefits. They won't reap all of the benefits because they'll go to Cigna and Medicare and elsewhere. And this is something that we have to, as a society, invest in, I believe. I believe we also need the buy-in of the private sector and the private insurance community, and it makes a lot of sense then to have it be a public-private partnership of some sort. I think it's a very difficult thing to figure out how you set up a system that stays free of politics, and that's going to be very hard to do. But I'll use Julie's "Don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good." I think we need to start on this. I think we need to make a whack at it as early as possible. I think several key things can help. One, there's a lot of comparative effectiveness and other research that's now going on both in the United States and elsewhere. If you attract the real experts, give them a fairly open hand and some protection from the politics of it in terms of loss of funding very quickly, I think you can make a lot of progress. And then you also have to spend, though, a lot of resources in educating a public that's very skeptical about something that looks like it may deny benefits to somebody about something. And that is a big challenge and something I think we need to, as a society, kind of embrace and move forward on. But I do think that it is one of the real possibilities of having a win-win. I'm not convinced that we're not, as a society, willing to continue spending a lot on health care. As a rich society, how many SUVs or Hummers can we have in everybody's driveway? We're going to spend our resources on something, and better health care makes a lot of sense, but we want to get value for our dollars. And I think that one of the things that we need to do is invest in this comparative effectiveness work. And I think it largely has to be a government role subsidized in part by the private sector with a very carefully designed set of funding that keeps it as much as possible free from the vagaries of one guy getting upset because his back surgeon is going to get skewered by this.
Yeah, I think that it is a public good. I think it should be financed by all payers. Other countries do it. We could do it better. But the private sector today has the data, and they're doing this. But they're doing it for competitive purposes. And that's a problem, that we need to make sure that we're using this for the benefit of all of us and for the benefit of taxpayers, not just to favor one insurer over another.
The only thing I would add to that, John, is I think it's not just the one insurer over another issue. I think more to Marilyn's point, there is a worry The same kind of worry there is when you try and figure out how to get to consistent measures of quality with providers, that that information is going to be used to deny payment or to deny treatment and to move towards something that people fear is like cookbook medicine. But I think that it's very important that we move forward and look at how to get to all of these things, consistent quality measures, comparative effectiveness, but we do it in a way that makes people, you know, trust in the process. And right now, I don't think there is a lot of trust in that process.
But, Peter, we also know that when
I was going to escape one round.
know that some things sound really good and sound easy and seem to be the magic bullet to get us out of our health care cost problem. And is this being a little overhyped? Is what's the promise here?
Well, I would say it's a silver bullet but not a magic bullet. And by that I mean the following. I think it does hold significant promise. CBO has said that it could, especially if it were tied to changes in financial incentives, especially for providers, and I think that's a key linkage. Again, tying whatever information you have to financial incentives for better care rather than more care is essential, I believe, to changing the practice of medicine. If you did that, I do think you would start to improve the efficiency of the health system. Now, in the Institute of Medicine world, everyone says, yes, that's exactly right. Bravo. In traditional budget world, people say, whoa, that sounds too easy. CBO is not supposed to say things like that. And I want to make it clear, this is not easy. I think it's right. I think it will ultimately work if it's done. But do not kid yourself that this is easy. Costs for beneficiaries are income to providers. And when you say this thing doesn't work as well as that thing, you are telling company A that their thing doesn't work as well as company B's. Or whatever it may be. And that the political economy of that and the need, as Marilyn said, for some independence and insulation so that the results are resistant to the pressures that will come to bear on it is absolutely essential, let alone when you then start to change the financial incentives tied to that. So make no mistake, I think it has very substantial potential, but this is not a cakewalk. And thinking that this is, it's easy to talk about it at the abstract level, and of course you have to be in favor of more information. And I like to say, how can you be against this if you favor consumer-directed health approach? The consumers need the information. You favor a single payer, the single payer needs the information. You favor something in between, then consumers, state governments, insurance firms, Medicare, Medicaid need the information. How can you be against the information? And at that level of abstraction, I think it's very hard to make a counterargument. The difficulty is going to be – and also I do believe that if we are going to bend that curve and get more efficiency out of our health system, this is one of the key necessary but not sufficient investments. But again, the rubber will hit the road once you actually start doing it and the results start coming out and there are players in the health system that don't like the results. And that's when – you need to be thinking ahead of time about the sustainability of whatever structure you set up.
Chris Langston, John Hartford Foundation. This was actually also my question about how to get more information to answer the question we all want to know, which is which services actually provide health and what do you want to pay for and what do you want people to get versus what you don't. And I appreciate the point that when you don't want to pay for something, that hurts somebody. But I'd like to follow up then specifically on this issue of the political sensitivity that I think a number of you are pointing to. It's certainly CMS itself has an enormous amount of information that it's not using, I think, very effectively. It also, as opposed to private insurers and other participants in the healthcare system, has the patient population that really is of interest here. I mean, the older people with complex medical issues that are not seen as frequently in the commercial sector is something that's different, that people know less about in the private sector. So I wonder, to press on this, isn't there some way that CMS could be given more resources to actually use its position as a payer and an information collector to actually answer some of these questions for us about what buys really good health outcomes?
I think the answer is yes.
Go ahead, John.
Well, of course, that would trigger even faster then, because administrative overhead's on the general revenue side. So the irony here.
let me say, that first, there are some impediments to CMS acting under current law. There's some ambiguity about the degree to which CMS can make decisions based on cost effectiveness rather than just effectiveness. There has been some limited movement towards sort of coverage with evidence development and some other ways of trying to build more registries and what have you. But the statutory ability of CMS currently to do a lot more of this is at least somewhat constrained, let alone the political economy of it. I'd also point out a point that I've made before, and this is to our colleagues from the legislative branch of the world, that we are not using as well as we could the demonstration project part of CMS, and that there are lots of demonstration projects that are mandated or instructed by the Congress that are not particularly well designed or not particularly targeted towards. I guess that was a courageous statement, wasn't it, given that I'm going to an appropriations hearing next week. But in any case, that are not particularly well designed and that are not particularly designed towards teaching us things. And CMS is then somewhat constrained in its ability to conduct demonstration projects that will actually yield teachable lessons for the overall healthcare system and for Medicare itself. So short answer is there's a lot more that we could be doing. There are various impediments to that happening, and hopefully we can move forward and make that better.
And in addition, the research funding for CMS has dropped precipitously in recent years. And
a lot of it's earmarked.
Yes, and a lot of it's earmarked. And I would, as from the research side, I would say that the evaluations for these often poorly designed demonstrations are often inadequate as well.
The only thing I would add is that there is an effort underway, and I don't think I don't think there's been anything reported on how it's working exactly yet. But there are efforts underway through a CMS ARC demonstration to utilize Medicare claims data in a more broad-based way in a number of different communities around the country to get to something that is more consistent quality measure that the providers and the payers in an area would agree on and utilize in a way to see if it is an effective use of that kind of information.
Ken Apfel, the Maryland School of Public Policy. Question about better fiscal information. If you could drill down a little bit deeper on ways to strengthen the trustees' report to provide better information in this area, and also budget tools. You know, the trigger is goofy. Don't we need some form of better budget enforcement mechanisms what are some of the alternatives that we have to think about using budget tools to help us deal with this healthcare challenge in better ways than we have to date? Assuming that the trigger doesn't do it, which it doesn't.
Do you want to, let me say a couple things. One, I would just point out, I'm not going to comment on the trustees report. I will point out that CBO is now doing Medicare and Medicaid projections over 75 years, and I would welcome suggestions as to what other information people would like to see in our reports. I think we're trying to provide a full array of metrics and be very transparent about our assumptions and about the underlying analytics. I'd say a couple things on the budget. First, we need to just be clear. I think the political economy in our political system of dealing with gradual long-term problems is not good. And that holds for the overall fiscal problem. It holds for healthcare. It holds for climate change. All sorts of things that are, at least in projections, gradual long-term problems have an inherent difficulty associated with them, which I like to call the M&M problem. Eating each individual M&M, it's only like 2 or 3 calories, so you eat one, and what's the big deal? It's just one. And then you keep doing it, and you've eaten the whole bag, and then it's like 300 or 400 calories. Same thing. You cannot argue that failing to deal with this problem today rather than 10 days from today or a year from today or 2 years from today will, cause a crisis. And, in fact, frankly, I think attempts to create an artificial sense of crisis, which have been attempted in other settings, just simply don't work. And so it raises the question of what will, and I don't have an answer to that. It may be the case that, some people's theory of the case is if we just put out scarier long-term numbers, that'll force action. Maybe not. I'm a little bit skeptical. Some people think that we need a some sort of budget enforcement mechanism, not just on a PAYGO basis, which makes sure we don't dig the hole deeper, but with regard to the underlying hole itself. It's hard to kind of come up with specific mechanisms that actually don't wind up actually helping or that wind up actually working. There are some attempts. You may know Senator Conrad and Senator Gregg have a proposal for one approach to dealing with the long-term budget problem. So I don't have. I actually have thought a fair amount about this, and I don't have an answer, which obviously for me is very frustrating.
I'd just like to say a couple of things. I think one thing is that putting it in the context of the contributions that individuals are making who are in the program and the contributions that taxpayers are making, making it real in some way is important, I believe, and putting it in a broader context. Government funding always focuses on, and CBO is required to, for example, the government costs and not society's costs. And I think we need some more focus on some of those issues as well. But I believe that one of the important things to also keep in mind is that entitlement programs, I believe, were created to have some long-range stability and predictability because you're asking people to contribute when they're 20 for something they're going to get when they're 70. And if that's the case, and I believe it is and it still is, then to subject these programs to tougher standards in terms of putting limits on spending than we do for other things, I think it creates some problems. And that's one of the issues that I've always had with the trigger. It puts in place a notion that it's not legitimate to spend general revenue funds on health care, but it's fine to spend general revenue funds on a lot of other things that I'd put out there to cut first. So I think that we do have some real political problems in having the guts to do things about this, but I think sometimes the emphasis is all in the direction of trying to figure out ways in which you can cut the entitlement programs, and I find that emphasis in our society a little bit screwy.
Well, I'm going to end on an optimistic note. A year from now, I think we'll be in the middle of a very large effort to reform our healthcare system, and we should ask a question that's implicit in the trigger, which is, what's the measure of success? What are we trying to accomplish, and how can we measure it? So measures of access, measures of equity, measures of financial protection and affordability, ease of use for patients, for providers, satisfaction, and dedicated funding and the sustainability of that are all going to be on the table next year. And I think we should really think about setting up a system of measurement, if you will, or accountability or some other way of identifying what we want the system to accomplish, and then Medicare becomes part of that. So it's not about the ratio between dedicated sources and general revenues. It's really about how do we assess the performance of our healthcare system and how do we assess the components within it, including the very important component of Medicare.
And I'll just say in conclusion that, you know, something I said when I was speaking. We are having this conversation now, and I think that's an important thing. And if the trigger did anything to generate that, if the trigger is going to do something that's going to generate a congressional conversation about this, whether the measures are perfect or not perfect, or we need more, or we need to look at other elements, I think it's important we're having this conversation now. And I'll close.
Well, our time has passed very quickly, and I must say that I think of all the panels I've ever moderated, this is the only one in which every question was answered by all panelists and in which we had such a lively discussion, and I hope it has shed a lot of light on the challenges and issues facing not only the Medicare program but our healthcare system and put the trigger in its proper perspective. And so thank you all, and thank you especially to the panelists who have been terrific.